You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did America's first and most beloved celebrity chef help the Allies emerge victorious from World War II? When we think of Julia Child, most of us picture her in an apron rather than a trench coat and fedora. But in fact, she spent several years in Asia, serving in the Office of Strategic Services, the predecessor to the modern CIA, during and after the war. Her time there not only honed her organizational and communication skills, but also introduced her to colleagues who would become lifelong friends, including her future husband. Journalist Jeanette Conant tells the story in her new book, A Covert Affair, Julia Child and Paul Child in the OSS. Jeanette, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Julia Child, then Julia McWilliams, is in some ways like the classic late bloomer story. Yeah. Can you talk about what her life was like before she signed on with the OSS?
Well, you know, she was from a very comfortable background. She was from an upper class Pasadena family. Her father was a successful rancher. She had plenty of money. She went to Smith College, and she did what a lot of girls did when they got out of school in those days. She came home. She played a lot of golf and tennis. She hung out at the country club and went to parties. And she was sort of expected to marry. And she didn't. And she felt, you know, she wrote in her diary that she felt she was a big girl and had a big destiny. And she was frustrated that it didn't pan out. She had ambitions of being a great lady novelist, and she went to New York with a group of friends, but all of her submissions to the New Yorker magazine were rejected, and she ended up coming home sort of disappointed. She tried advertising and ended up getting fired. So she was unemployed and a bit at odds with herself when the war broke out.
And she, you talk about her being a big girl. She had volunteered for both the Army and the Navy, but they wouldn't take her for exactly that reason.
She got a physical disqualification, too tall to serve her country.
It's funny to think of that in today's world where a tall, strong soldier would be delightful.
Well, I know it was very frustrating for her. You know, she'd grown up in the Hollywood Hills. She was a very good shot. You know, she was a tomboy. And even when she joined the OSS, it was frustrating to her that she couldn't be trained as a spy because she really wanted to be that type. She saw herself as sort of rugged, but she didn't have the skills. You know, she constantly laments in her diary, "I'm a plain person with no talents." She had no language skills. As she said, 17 years of high school and college French, and she couldn't speak a word. That wasn't uncommon for Americans. And she hadn't traveled. She'd never been further outside of America than Tijuana. So she was really a very inexperienced person. And she was lucky to land at the OSS, but she couldn't get the kind of job there that she wanted initially.
So, Jenny, talk about the state of U.S. foreign intelligence, or perhaps we should say the lack of U.S. foreign intelligence, in the years leading up to World War II.
Well, we had no foreign intelligence. We had the FBI, which was really a domestic police force. So as in the early days of World War II, we were sitting out the war and Europe was at war, we had no protection against foreign spies. And, of course, the Germans were moving all around us into South America. And, of course, there were German spies coming into America. And there was a lot of espionage that people forget goes on in wartime even before a country is involved. There's industrial espionage. There's, you know, rubber and chemicals and oil. And there's economic espionage. And so we were very naive about this, and we had no ability to report on this, and we were completely dependent on our European allies. And the British were begging us to become more sophisticated and organize our own espionage agency. And finally, they talked Roosevelt into it, and he hastily organized the OSS.
So Roosevelt puts in charge of this brand new agency this guy known as Wild Bill Donovan, and he had very particular tastes when it came to hiring people.
He did. Well, you know, he was a great war hero, and then he had been a lawyer, a Wall Street lawyer, no less, and he did what most lawyers do. He hired other lawyers. So all of the upper echelons of the OSS were staffed by people from his own firm and other leading law firms. But that said, you know, he had to build this enormous intelligence gathering network virtually overnight. So he went and started hiring people from the Ivy Leagues, you know, first-rate academics. But they were, you know, unusual types, you know, you would think for that kind of work. You had mathematicians and archaeologists and anthropologists and linguists and even sort of ornithologists. You know, if you were a rare bird guy and you had chased you know, feathers across Southeast Asia and sort of knew the language and knew the land, he would make you sort of head of the Burma desk. And so you had some very exotic people in very responsible jobs. And so the OSS got rather a reputation because, of course, these people all had sisters and girlfriends. Many of them had gone to the Seven Sisters colleges like Smith and Holyoke, and they could be quickly vetted and approved in a very, you know, security-conscious job. So it got a reputation for only hiring from the Ivy League and the Junior League. And that got OSS the reputation as being oh so social in Washington.
It did, however, make Julia Child, then McWilliams, a perfect fit.
It did. You know, she joked in her diary that she finally found a place where she had the job qualifications. She had the perfect fit. Donovan also liked to hire people from wealthy families because he thought it meant that it was harder to bribe them. And so Julia had some private income because her mother had recently died and left her something. So she perfectly fit in, and she got recruited by the OSS, and she got promoted, and she just loved it. One of her first jobs was working for a Harvard zoologist, preparing protection kits, rescue kits for pilots who had been downed at sea. And her job is to go to the fish market every day and get the fresh catch. And they would bring it back and do all these experiments to develop a very stinky shark repellent for pilots waiting to be rescued. And she just loved the work. She thought it was very exotic and glamorous, and she loved these sort of brainy, eccentric colleagues. And she felt at home in the OSS.
And as you mentioned, she was never a spy in the classic sense. But as she works her way up through the OSS, she's essentially responsible for the nerve center of the entire organization.
Yeah, she would play it down in later life, but she really had a very responsible job. And her OSS colleagues, that I was fortunate to interview a number of them, said that it carried very, very grave responsibilities. And she was entrusted with it because she was just seen as absolutely trustworthy and discreet and someone that was utterly reliable. The nerve center, they called it the brain bank. The formal title was the OSS registry. And every classified document crossed her desk. Every cable from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, every classified telegram and message, all the plans for upcoming invasions, she would have seen all of them weeks and weeks before they happened. The OSS code books were in her possession. The locations of every secret OSS mission and field unit, all of the agents that were working behind enemy lines, their aliases. Really, it was an incredibly responsible position. And in typical style, even then, you know, and it was really a very grueling job with absolutely exhausting hours, and she had a staff to run and everything. She would joke and say that she developed a top-secret twitch from handling so much highly sensitive material.
And she was not simply getting it to where it needed to go, but there had to be interpretation involved in that.
Oh, yes, and she did some of the decoding herself, and the funny thing is, you know, the OSS just loved acronyms, and it was very confusing, and you had all these different agencies reporting to one another and fighting, and their codes wouldn't always cross-check, so she did quite a bit of reorganizing and wiring angrily back to Washington, demanding that people get their acts together so that everything would work more efficiently. She really, as she proved later in the kitchen, she had a very organized mind. She was very methodical and highly disciplined person, and she imposed that order on the OSS registry, and it was really enormously helpful to her detachment.
This was an interesting time, too, because in the rest of America, women were not thought of as particularly valuable, but they were very much integral to this organization. Can you tell us a little bit about Jane Foster and Betty McDonald and what their jobs were?
Well, the important thing is to remember there was a man shortage. So when you were building a large civilian espionage agency, you're going to have to employ women. And as a result, women had far more opportunities at the OSS, particularly if you were a woman who had traveled abroad and knew foreign countries well and knew foreign languages well. If that was the case, you really could advance very quickly at the OSS. And in the case of Jane Foster, she was much like Julia. She was a wealthy California girl. She joined for, you know, seeking adventure. But she was enormously sophisticated, very widely traveled throughout Europe and Southeast Asia, and she spoke quite a number of languages, and she was absolutely fluent in Malay as well as French and Italian. And so she was immediately recruited to be a counterintelligence agent with a specialty in those countries where she spoke the languages. And she really was able to advance, as was Betty McDonald, another OSS officer who I talk about, she had been in Honolulu as a young reporter. She'd been studying Japanese. She was one of the first reporters on the scene after the Pearl Harbor attack, so she had real sort of frontline experience in reporting on the damage and the death toll in Hawaii, and then she, like so many people in Hawaii at the time, she had small handgun training. She really had helped set up the barbed wire barriers when they had feared a Japanese invasion. So she was quite a tough young woman, and she was recruited by the OSS because of her language skills. And she did a lot of counterintelligence work and counter-propaganda work against the Japanese. So Julia, while she was the same age as these women, was in the company of some very sophisticated women that were being trained as agents.
And Betty McDonald is still alive, is that right?
And she is. She was enormous, enormous help to me in doing this book. I was able to call her at every stage and not only ask for anecdotes, but she could tell me the mood, the morale, their literally what they were thinking at the time. Her recall was just tremendous. And she had her own letters and diaries and notes, as well as the photographs that we put in the book. So it was just tremendous.
And in a way, Jenny, when you describe some of these relationships, it's almost like those really tight, intense bonds we form in college with people who are all sort of thrown into the same situation together.
Well, you know, it's funny that you should say that. They constantly refer to the OSS as being like a liberal arts college. And it had the same embrace for eccentrics and intellectuals and sort of oddballs. It was a very remarkable group, and many of them, because they were academics, had come from a college setting, and it had that feel. And remember, in the OSS, when they were stationed, Julia and Paul Child were in Ceylon with Jane Foster, and then in China. And they had, you know, they were on small campuses, essentially. They were small headquarters, often within a walled compound. They had breakfast, lunch, and dinner together. And because it was wartime and they were in dangerous environments in foreign countries, they couldn't go anywhere on their own. So if they did make the odd field trip to a local restaurant or a scenic spot, they would go together on weekends. So they were together 24 hours a day, working and playing and eating and drinking. And so in that sense, it was very collegiate. It was very, very tight-knit. And they really treated each other as family during the war and then after the war.
Now, Jane had had previous ties to the Communist Party, but this was not a big deal in the OSS when she was there initially?
It was not. You know, what Americans forget is that Russia was our ally during the war. The catchphrase of the day is, you know, we're fighting the fascists, not the communists. Mm-hmm. So that whole concern about communists really faded during the war. And for the OSS, if you had been a member of the Communist Party or had flirted with socialism, which really a lot of which in the 1930s had to do with labor unions and things like that, that was not a big deal. It was not a bar to being employed. And again, in Southeast Asia, where the OSS was operating field units, many of our best agents that we hired in Southeast Asia and Indochina and in China were local communist agents, which were very effective at getting behind Japanese lines and reporting on Japanese troop movements. So we hired them, and they worked for us. So people forget that it was a very sort of fluid time, and we were, our issue was not with the communists in the 1940s.
We're going to talk in a few minutes about how that started to change over time, particularly during the Cold War. My guest this hour is journalist Jeanette Conant. Her new book is called A Covert Affair, Julia Child and Paul Child in the OSS. You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Jeanette Conant. Her new book is called A Covert Affair, Julia Child and Paul Child in the OSS. So, Jenny, let's talk about Paul Child, whom Julia met when they were both in Ceylon, now Sri Lanka. They would eventually fall deeply in love. At the outset, though, the attraction was absolutely one-sided.
It was. You know, when they met, he was a decade older, a head shorter, and really as different as could be. He was very, very liberal politically. He had been teaching in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in various boys' schools. He had taught French and art. He was a painter, but he was self-taught. He dropped out of college. He had worked his way around the world as a sailor. He had a black belt in judo. He really was an odd character, I think, and he very much considered himself a connoisseur of the finer things in life, you know, of food, of literature, of poetry, of fashion, and above all, women. And he loved beautiful, beautiful women, very elegant women, and he chased every lovely girl that came through the OSS, and he really regarded tall, gawky Julia as just sort of a good kid.
In fact, he liked Jane Foster.
He did. He adored Jane Foster. Jane Foster was like Paul in the sense that she had traveled all over the world. She spoke perfect French, and she was an artist by training. She was also a painter. You know, he was an artist who was recruited to build war rooms for the Allied generals. You know, he would make those elaborate maps with modeling clay and great designs and post, you know, posters on the wall of upcoming invasions, colorful charts and diagrams. He was brilliant at that sort of thing. So he and Jane had everything in common, and they would go off and look at local artists and that kind of thing together on weekends. They would work on projects together and consult each other on propaganda that they were developing. So they worked together. They had the same sorts of interests, and he just really spent every day with her. They planned to have most of their dinners together, and Julia felt very much to be the third wheel.
So she's figured, well, he's never going to like me romantically, but I can at least have him as a mentor.
Yes, she interestingly, she wrote in her diary that she wanted to have him in her life no matter what, even as a friend, and she was determined to become someone that he found interesting. So if he read a book, she would immediately go off, read that one and two more. If he mentioned that he liked poetry, she would go back and read all the poetry that she could get her hands on. He was fascinated by politics, and she knew very little about politics, so she started reading the foreign news sections of the newspapers to become more sophisticated about international affairs. It was really almost a Pygmalion-type transformation, and one of the most amusing areas was food. She was a meat and potatoes girl from from California. She couldn't boil water, and here he was, somebody who adored French food and very sophisticated cuisines, and he was always organizing these culinary adventures to go off and try Indian curries in and around Ceylon, and then Chinese delicacies all around Kunming and Chongqing, where they were based. And Julia, who knew nothing about foreign food, constantly volunteered to go because she wanted to prove to him that she was adventurous and had a sophisticated palate and wouldn't balk at eating pig's knuckles or snails and things like that.
What sort of reporting back to Washington did the OSS do, and what happened when the people in charge in the nation's capital didn't like what they were hearing?
Well, the OSS was really an intelligence operation. Their primary job was to report on what was going on. And, of course, what was going on in China was absolute chaos. We were officially, as a country, neutral in the Chinese Civil War between the nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong. But at the same time, we were pursuing the policy, which was almost impossible, of supporting Chiang Kai-shek's efforts to combat the Japanese, or so we thought. So we were funneling millions of dollars and lots of weapons to Chiang Kai-shek. But as we know now from 2020 hindsight, he was essentially a greedy warlord. He was a profiteer. He was keeping the money. He was embezzling it, as it were. He was keeping the arms because he wanted to fight the Chinese communists. He did not have any interest in protecting American soldiers from the Japanese. And the OSS was reporting a lot on this corruption and chaos and on the anemic state of his army. And this was not popular in Washington, and it was particularly not popular in Washington after the war. What people forget is that shortly after the war, in 1949, China fell to the communists under Mao, and Chiang Kai-shek had to seek refuge in Taiwan as a defeated exile. And we were shocked, shocked, shocked that we had somehow bungled policy in this area and allow communism to become successfully rooted in another large power. We were already intimidated by Russia and the spread of communism in Europe. So this was very alarming to the Truman administration. And what began was a lot of finger pointing and very reckless investigation into our leading State Department and OSS advisors as to how they could have allowed this to happen.
Why did Jane quit the agency when she did, Jane Foster?
Well, they all quit the agency, as it were, at the end of 1945 because it was disbanded. It was disbanded because it was unpopular and controversial, and the Army and Navy disapproved of much of what the OSS was up to. So the organization as itself came to an end at the end of 1945. But Jane Foster, like a lot of OSS people, was very disillusioned. You know, under Roosevelt and under the great New Deal idealism, when we had gone into these countries in Southeast Asia, we had promised to support democracy there. We had promised to support their efforts to overthrow colonial rule. But Roosevelt died, and Truman, in an effort to appease our European allies at the end of the war, reneged on that promise. And we let Europe go back and set up its colonial governments in countries like Burma and Indonesia and Indochina. And, of course, that immediately led to enormous unrest and revolution and violence in the streets because these countries had been fighting the Japanese for all these years. They'd been occupied and suffered terrible brutality and had been fighting. And they thought that not only were they fighting the Japanese, but they were fighting for their freedom. And they did not want to go back under the thumb of Dutch and French and British colonial governments. And so absolute revolution began to spread throughout these Southeast Asian territories. And many of the advisors, like Jane Foster, who had run agents, who had consulted to these local governments, felt that they had been betrayed by this policy, that the promises that they made had been broken, and they were very disillusioned and disappointed in the Truman administration.
Did that make her a good target for Soviet operatives?
Well, of course she was disgruntled and angry. She was very outspoken and very public about it. She gave a lot of interviews when she came back to the San Francisco Chronicle. She wrote a very angry editorial in the New York Times. She was not alone in voicing her disappointment. She was going to work on a book about it, in fact. So people that were angry might have been targets for the Soviet Union, sure.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with Jeanette Conant about her new book, A Covert Affair, Julia Child and Paul Child in the OSS. Let's go on the phones now to Marshall in Dallas. Hello, Marshall.
Hi. Back in the 1960s when I was in high school, it was in Okinawa, Japan during the Vietnam War, and a friend of mine whose last name is Freeman told me his father served with Julia Child. Well, he didn't tell me this until actually last year, but apparently he had served with a child in the OSS in China, and I was wondering if you had come across that name.
I didn't, but you know, there were a lot of people in China. She was in Kunming, and she was in Chongqing before that, so there were a lot of military personnel there as well as OSS. And so it's more than likely, but I don't recognize the name.
Talk for a minute about what it took to go through all these recently declassified documents and sort of pair them up with the things that had been out there and with personal accounts and figure out exactly what was happening in all these very complicated stories.
Well, it's a huge effort. It's a lot of fun getting the classified documents because it's like a treasure hunt. You're looking for all this information that's never come out before. So I took advantage of the declassification and went after all of the OSS records of Paul and Julia and all of their colleagues as well as their commanding officers so I could see where they were and what they were doing. And I could see many of the actual memos that went back and forth between the OSS detachments and Washington, and you can really see the chaos of the policy unfold. There are constant pleas from the OSS commanders for policy clarifications because they really have absolutely no idea what they're doing in China and what they're supposed to say. And we just didn't have really much of an official policy, and events really overtook us so quickly that we didn't clarify it, and the poor OSS was really left in a very confused state there. And then I went after their FBI files later so you could see, really track the change in policy in the late 40s as communism overtook every other concern in our foreign policy to be the major fear. And then suddenly all these people who had served in China and had been there And had been sort of critical of Chiang Kai-shek and sympathetic to Mao, and perhaps had allowed communism to spread in China, fell under suspicion, and you can really see it develop in these FBI files. It was just fascinating to get these papers and just read it step by step and see the sea change in our foreign policy and how that affected these individuals' lives.
And that change affected, among other people, Jane Foster was accused, and then later on, simply, I think by nature of his friendship, Paul Child was accused.
Yeah, it's called guilt by association.
Yeah.
Jane Foster became the target of one of the largest spy investigations of the 1950s. It was a huge international investigation, more than 14 years. It involved round-the-clock surveillance. It involved high-tech surveillance, which was very new at the time. They opened mail, and they investigated all of her friends. And because Paul Child was one of her closest friends, and then again in the 1950s when they were all in Paris, Paul and Jane and Julia were very close. They had dinner all the time. The FBI was convinced that there was perhaps some link between Paul Child and Jane Foster, that Paul was very leftist, and they initiated a full loyalty inquiry. He was dragged back to Washington and forced to submit to lengthy interrogations. Then they investigated all of his friends and past employers and family going back 10 years. Hmm. They thought his brother might be a communist, his sister-in-law might be a communist. They really suspected him of all kinds of, as they said, sort of nasty, subversive proclivities, including his sexual leanings, which, you know, he was a longtime bachelor. He was almost 45 by the time he got married, and they wondered if he was a homosexual. He had taught in boys' school, so does that mean he was possibly a pedophile? You know, it was nasty in those days, and Paul Child's FBI file is just hair-raising.
And he and Julia never turned around and said, it wasn't us, look at Jane Foster.
No, you know, they really were very brave. They came to understand after the investigation continued, ultimately, that it was Jane Foster that was the focus. And they realized, through guesswork and putting the pieces together, that they must have hit upon Paul's name either among her papers or somebody had said that they were very close during the war and that he had fallen under suspicion because of that association. But they were appalled. You know, they had seen some of their closest friends dragged through Senate committees and their careers destroyed. Men like Jack Service and John Patton Davies and many of our leading State Department officials had been their closest friends in China. The journalist Teddy White, who most people know from his Making of the President series, mm-hmm. but he had covered China for Time magazine and written a bestseller called Thunder Out of China, and he was persecuted by McCarthy as a possible traitor. His book had been too sympathetic to Mao, too critical of Chiang Kai-shek. He had his passport confiscated. He was accused of being a traitor, and he ultimately fled to France to sort of avoid being blacklisted. And they were very close to him while they were living in France. So this was happening to everyone they knew, and they really chose to be brave and to stick by their principles and their friends.
It must have seemed like the entire world was upside down to have worked so hard to serve the country and then be accused of the most terrible kind of disloyalty.
It did, and it's so interesting you used that phrase. Julia used that same phrase at various times in her diary, and I include many of their diary and anecdotes from their letters because their fear is just palpable. He worked at the State Department when he was in Europe, in Paris, and then later in Germany. He was in the propaganda arm, and they felt that the world was sort of closing in on them. It was becoming a scarier place, a more paranoid place. And as his colleagues, one by one, were being transferred and having their promotions canceled and being investigated, Julia wonders aloud at one point. She says, I'm terrified of McCarthyism. I feel very scared for Paul. What can I do? Hmm. And you can really feel her growing anxiety.
Did you ever, Jenny, reading her diaries, get the slightest inkling that there was a moment when she wondered for herself whether she should trust her husband?
No. And their love was absolute and their trust was absolute. And they knew from their many friends that were being involved that this was a change in the political climate that was unfair and very extreme. And they very much blamed McCarthy for stirring up this kind of anxiety and paranoia in the media. I think they were sensible people and they sort of knew that this too would pass, but the question was how much damage would be done. and, you know, before there was a political sea change, and how did you survive it? They understood that it had to be survived. And her whole concern from beginning to end was, how would Paul survive this? How much would it mark his career? And Paul was very pessimistic. He said right through the investigation, I will never be promoted again after this. This is a stain that cannot be erased.
Somehow in this conversation, we managed to leapfrog over the moment when he actually realized he was in love with her, but it's sort of a charming process. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it is. It's a charming story because these two people really formed their relationship on the basis of companionship. They were together in the war in this very lonely place at the end in Kunming, China. I think a lot of their colleagues had paired up. Even if they were married, their marriages by then had fallen apart, so you had many couples forming all around them. And they really sort of were left to themselves, and they became very, very close friends. And perhaps even in a latter-day victory celebration, lovers. But it was not really a romance yet. It was really a meeting of minds, and what is really clear from their letters and diaries is they came together out of tremendous loneliness. And I think it's very moving to read their descriptions of that ache and that pain of being terribly alone in the world. And when they separated after the war and she went back to California and he to Washington, he was very unconvinced that she was the right woman for him. She desperately wanted to make him understand that she was.
Let me have you pause there so we can take a quick break, and we'll come back to finish that story. My guest is journalist Jeanette Conant. Her new book is called A Covert Affair, Julia Child and Paul Child in the OSS. You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Jeanette Conant, author of the new book, A Covert Affair, Julia Child and Paul Child in the OSS. So, Jenny, we have this palpable ache where they're both very lonely, they're writing letters back and forth, and Julia Child is thinking to herself and practically saying, but not quite, why can't you see me right here waiting for you?
Yes, and she writes from these letters, and it's just the letters are remarkable. It was literally a long-distance romance, and she just, her personality and her warmth and her zest for life just reaches out to him through these letters, and she's proving to him with every letter that she is the kind of woman that he would want to spend his life with. So she subscribes to the Washington Post and the New York Times so she can be reading what he's reading and engage him in conversations about politics and foreign affairs and articles that are in the paper. She starts reading the novels of Henry Miller, which were very sexy for the day, to sort of show that she was not squeamish on that subject, even though she was an old maid and unmarried. She takes music lessons because she knows he loves music and is studying the piano, and she takes her first cooking lessons so that she can make him a homemade meal if he comes to visit her. So you see her reaching out in every direction to broaden her horizons and prove to Paul that she is the kind of exciting, sophisticated woman that he would enjoy spending his life with.
Was he bothered by the fact or put off by the fact that she was not sexually experienced?
He was. You know, he was an older man. He'd had a very, very long love affair with a woman, and he felt that the age difference and the huge gap in their experience was a bar. He was worried, frankly, I think, that he would become involved with Julia and it would not go well and that he would disappoint her or hurt her. He was very, very fond of her, but he was just not sure that this was the right kind of relationship. He worried in his diary that she was a grown-up little girl and that it was sort of beyond him to educate her. And what's interesting is that Julia took on that education upon herself and just proved to Paul at the end of the nine-month period that they were apart that she really had changed and was a woman worthy of his love. And some of that language may sound strange to people or a little bit Henry Higgins-ish, but there was that element in their relationship. And when he finally realized that Julia was for the woman for him, he chastised himself. He said, I was blind. I was constantly chasing these young girls. I didn't see that this brilliant woman was right in front of me. And he grew up as well. And they just made a wonderful pair, but it took them a while to get there. And I think it's very interesting for people to see how that romance develops.
But from the moment he committed to her, it was exceptionally passionate. They were just mad about each other.
They were. And again, I think it comes out of that enormous loneliness. I can't stress enough, and it's really in the letters and diaries that I include in the book, how unhappy they both were. They were just unbelievably miserable and lonely. So when they found each other, I just don't think a day went by that they weren't grateful to God, to themselves, for their happiness. They spent every moment together they could. They hated to be apart. And then they ultimately worked together really as a team on her cookbooks and her television show, and they just loved every minute of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Ellis is curious to know, writing in an email, whether or not you did any research on Senator Noland of California and the China lobby in the Red Scare and the investigation of Owen Lattimore and the Institute of Pacific Relations.
I did. It's very interesting. The Institute of Pacific Relations was an institute that Jane Foster was attached to. And in fact, she would speak out against what she saw in Indonesia there, and they would publish her report. Owen Lattimore, of course, was one of the key China hands, one of these leading State Department officials who was our advisor during the war in China, who was persecuted by McCarthy, dragged through Senate hearings, and had his career destroyed. And he was a friend of Julia and Paul Childs. So his story is included in the book. And he's one of the many people that they were so upset by what happened to him and greatly increased their disenchantment in the State Department. And it was one of the many reasons that Paul took early retirement, really. He just did not, he'd lost his taste for that kind of work.
Now, Jane managed to avoid ever going to trial. Is that right?
Well, what happened is when she was accused, she was living in Paris. Paul and Julia had been with her in Paris. They had just been transferred to Germany. And the French do not like to extradite political people for political persecution. Mm-hmm. They give refuge to political exiles. And so they refused extradition. And so Jane Foster never returned back to the United States to stand trial. The Attorney General kept begging that she come back to the United States. But, you know, you have to remember with the example of the Rosenbergs right in front of her, she was not tempted to go back to the United States and try and clear her name with a risk of a death sentence hanging over her head.
So she lived the rest of her life in France.
As did a number of other people that were in that same FBI investigation. Martha Dodd Stern, another very wealthy socialite who was accused of being a communist, she fled to Mexico and then to Cuba and lived out her years in exile as well with her husband, Alfred Stern, a wealthy investment banker. They were also afraid to return and stand trial.
There are some great photographs in the book, but there are also some plates of Jane's art as she responded to these accusations, and they're really heartbreaking. Can you describe some of them for us?
Oh, they are heartbreaking. You know, when she was in the United States, she came back at one point in 1955 because her mother was very, very ill. She thought her mother was going to die, and she knew it was a risky time in America, but she came back anyway, and she was just horrified to find herself under investigation by the FBI. Her passport was confiscated, and she couldn't get out, and she had a nervous breakdown and went into a mental hospital in New York. As her parents wrote, one relative, it was the one place, you know, the FBI couldn't get her. But she did a series of paintings there, and there's one self-portrait, which I include in the book, which is just haunting, where you can see how depressed and perhaps scared she is. She does another a drawing when she goes before the Passport Investigation Committee, and it's sort of an eerie tribunal, and it's quite a frightening picture. So she was a very talented artist, and I include a few images just to give a sort of insight into her emotional state as well as her gift.
Did most of the key players that you write about in this book keep really regular diaries?
They did. You know, the resources I had to draw on were tremendous. And in fact, not only do I keep, not only do I have the materials of the key players in this book, but I also drew on the diaries of a number of other people who I don't feature just because there were a lot of characters in this book, but their families of other OSS people were kind enough to give me the letters and diaries, for example, of Ellie Theory, who was in Washington and Ceylon in China with Julie and Paul Child. I had her diaries and letters. I mean, I just had extraordinary amount of material because in those days people really wrote what happened to them every day. You know, they wrote the weather, what they ate. I had incredible resources to draw on.
I guess they weren't wasting their time online and posting random things on Facebook, so they had time to put down a journal.
They saved everything. That's the other thing. They saved everything. So it was just an incredible resource of material.
Were there times when you got these recently declassified documents, and I know that you're a journalist, but was it hard sometimes to make sense of what you were reading, and what did you do in those cases?
It was very hard in the beginning with the FBI files. They didn't make a lot of sense. They were very jumbled, and they got a lot wrong, as you would in the early stages of investigation. All you could do is just keep assembling the files, and what I did with this book is I could cross-check everything, so I just kept referring back to original incidents, letters, diaries. Then I would cross-check it with the FBI files and the OSS documents. You really couldn't rely on just one thing because it might be wrong. So it really takes a lot of effort, particularly in the 1950s when the accusations start flying, because then you know that it's nothing is reliable. And then I relied much more heavily on the correspondence between Jane and Julia and Paul and their friends, Betty McDonald, because their voices were more reasonable than the official voices, sadly enough, at that time.
It must have been interesting, too, to take some of those official documents and then match them up by date with what they were writing in their letters and in their journals.
You know, it was, and it's fascinating. At one point, you know, the OSS, the FBI drops in on Julia and Paul. They've just returned to the United States, and they're in Washington, and interrogates Julia about Jane Foster, and Julia makes a note of it in her date book, you know, that the FBI came by. But she knew what was going on, and she knew to be very careful about what she said. It was just fascinating. And then, of course, to read about the account in the FBI file. They were looking for dirt on Jane Foster. But Julia, you know, she had a tremendous sense of loyalty. She understood what was going on historically, and she was really brave. They behaved so honorably, and you can't emphasize that enough because it was a very frightening time, and not everybody behaved as honorably as Julia and Paul.
And people didn't trust Jane's husband nearly as much as they trusted her.
No, she married a Russian, and a very odd Russian immigrant at that. He was an angry guy. He had a chip on his shoulder. His family had been quite well-to-do and had lost everything in the Bolshevik Revolution. And he was an angry, unhappy man and not a very nice man. He drank too much, and he could be quite abusive. And I think they thought he was a very odd character. But they weren't willing to sell him down the river, as it were, without proof. And they just felt, I think, they had seen too much in the way of hasty accusations and name-calling to just believe that he was a spy. I think they just thought it was ludicrous.
The book obviously centers on a very specific time in their lives, but I'm curious about what you know about how their relationship changed, Paul's and Julia's, when it was her career that people were most familiar with and when she was the one who was assumed when she walked into a room to be very sophisticated and worldly.
Well, I think he was immensely pleased. You know, I think it's very, one of the things I mentioned in the book at the end is that, you know, for the next 40 years of their marriage, and it really was a partnership. They did everything together. He would take the photographs for the book. He would do little drawings for the book. He would help her edit and index the book. And he traveled everywhere with her as a sort of de facto sort of stage manager. I think that his aesthetic became her aesthetic, and she really never stopped being grateful for all that he taught her, and she always used the plural. 20, 30 years later, reporters would come and talk to her about her cookbooks and her tremendous success on television, and she would always say, we. Hmm. We did this, we did that. And I think it was an ongoing tribute to Paul and everything Paul had taught her, even though Paul was very much in the background by that time. He was in many ways kind of a shy, prickly character. He was not the limelight, loving, charismatic person that his wife was. And then also, sadly, he really had, I think, early onset Alzheimer's and began to fade quite dramatically. And she really protected him. She took him everywhere with her. It was a loving and devoted relationship.
Obviously, it must have been just an extraordinary blow for her to lose him, and yet she seems to have not missed a beat in terms of carrying forward what they had started together.
Well, she adored her career. She just adored it. And they were, because they had no children, and because also they had started this wartime family of OSS colleagues, and then they expanded it to be their Paris friends and then all of their culinary friends and colleagues. Her work was her family. It was her life. So she really had a very vibrant, loving, devoted circle around her after Paul died, and they continued to be with her and see her, and so she drew enormous sustenance from that. She was just a very vital and engaged woman right to the end.
Why do you think we remain so fascinated by Julia Child even after she's been gone?
Well, I think that she was an iconic person. She was a pioneer, not only in the terms of changing American cuisines, but also she was a television pioneer. But more than that, I think what's partly why she left this enormous legacy of papers and personal diaries to Radcliffe is that she wanted people to see that she was not an overnight success. Mm-hmm. She really groped and stumbled her way forward. It was an easy journey for her as a woman, and she wanted other women and other people to see how hard she worked to get where she got. I think she thought the lessons from that were valuable. And so I think that's why she made all of these documents public, so that people could go and see the path that she traversed. And I think that was a tremendous gift she gave us, and one reason she remains sort of a teacher and an example today.
Jeanette Conant's new book is A Covert Affair, Julia Child and Paul Child in the OSS. Jeanette, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.